I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. Our guest today is Mary Read. Mary is a profound, experiential modern mystic who grew up devoutly agnostic. In 2011, she left her executive life in Washington, D.C. for a monastic life in the Himalayas. After struggling for 11 years with the impact of veering uncontrollably into otherworldly realms, encountering God, Jesus, Buddha, angels, and unfathomable wisdom. These events finally turned her life inside out, and now Mary says her work is simply to joyfully startle humanity awake. Today she travels the world detailing stunning mystical insights that reveal wildly inspiring and sorely needed perspectives that shed new light on the significance of these extraordinary times. Her memoir, Unwitting Mystic, Evolution of the Message of Love, is available through Amazon, and her website is unwittingmystic.com. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you very kindly. It's a pleasure to be here, Patricia.
First off, I just want to say how much I loved your book and was so moved by your experiences. And I just want to express my gratitude to you for not only embarking on this journey, and I know that you really probably felt like you didn't have a choice. The journey sort of grabbed you, but then also sharing it so widely with people. And it really is a gift to all of us. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, what it was like having these mystical experiences start coming to you while you were here in the U.S. What was that like for you, and why was it eventually essential that you go to India?
Well, it was profoundly confusing in the beginning because I don't have any kind of religious background. And at the time that it all started, I was working in a very big position in clinical research in Washington, D.C. So I had a very normal kind of life, and I had no interest in spirituality. I wasn't really a person that had a lot of questions about life. I was just very focused on doing what was joyful to me that I thought would be helpful to other people. And in the summer of 2000, now 18 years ago, I began to start having this voice that was really very deep that kept telling me I was supposed to be doing something very important, which of course I already thought I was because I was doing clinical research and, you know, supposedly helping a lot of people. But eventually that voice turned into starting to have these mystical experiences. And the very first experience I ever had in December of 2000 was going right into the body and being of Jesus on the cross at the moment of crucifixion. And that event unfolded over the course of 3.5 hours. And then the next day, going back into these divine realms and encountering godlike beings and angels and all sorts of things, these really profound experiences. And then, you know, having to go back into the office and do my normal work. So the juxtaposition of these really very different worlds began to start happening with me sort of spontaneously over the years. And it was just confusing as all get out, because in my normal day-to-day life, what I was living didn't match the profound simplicity and love and wisdom of these other realms. So it was really confusing. And I started to seek help because I didn't know how to process the profundity of what was going on. And I certainly didn't know how to talk about it. You know, these the realms that I go into are generally known as the realms beyond words. So I couldn't find words anywhere near the scale of what was happening. And most of all, I didn't know what to do with what was happening. So I started seeking help from therapists and more therapists and more therapists, and then doctors and Reiki practitioners and acupuncturists and shamans, and then back to the therapist. And no one could help me at all. And so I just, you know, I stumbled a lot over the course of about 11 years. And starting around the 10th year of trying to balance these two very discordant worlds, all of my normalcy finally just fell apart. And I lost every sense of my anchoring to a normal life. So I lost my job and my home, my relationship, my money, everything, just the bottom dropped out. And at the same time, all of this spiritual stuff was pushing quite hard against my psyche, and I still couldn't find any help. So finally, I just got to the point where I decided in my massive despair that this must all be a sign that it's time for me to go, and maybe my work was to be done from the other realms. And so that culminated in a serious suicide attempt in March of 2011. And at that time, I took 97 pain and sleeping pills with 3 glasses of wine. And then I laid down and I said my prayers and just thought that that was it. And then 2 days later, I just woke up. I woke up entirely on my own and very sick, and I had no ability to control my motor skills, but I was alive. And but I was still, I woke up in the same two worlds that I went to sleep in. And it was only then, in my massive state of pain and just total loss, feeling lost, that I just surrendered. I just stopped trying to figure anything out. I stopped trying to make a plan or fix anything. And I just said, you know, God, you can see I don't have any idea what I'm doing. So if there's something that you need me to do, you're going to have to be the project manager. I can't do it anymore. And immediately the doors just started flying open then, finally. And the right therapist came into my awareness almost right away. And she happened to have trained with somebody whose field of specialty was consciousness. So he was perfect to work with somebody like me. And then very quickly, these two just got me straight up on my feet. And within 6 months of, actually within 4 months of the suicide attempt, I was invited to India to meet with a high Tibetan Lama to talk about my experiences, and then ended up in the 6th month living in a Buddhist nunnery at the foothills of the Himalayas. And then my journey as a mystic began to unfold authentically then. So that was it.
Yes. And you mentioned a couple of times in your book how necessary it was that you have community that could hold you, that could provide.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think that in our culture here in the U.S., I think it's really difficult when people start having these experiences, because it's not clear, where do you go? Who can help you? And I think there's not as much of an awareness of that kind of phenomenon as there is, say, in a place like India that is so centered around spirituality. Have you found that to be the case?
Absolutely. But, you know, it's growing more and more that different kinds of community are evolving and sort of coming out of the woodworks. When I first started having these experiences, we didn't even have anything like Google to, you know, sort of do some research about what was out there. And as this sort of awakening is happening, even the specifics of the unique language around this awakening is different than like was in the religious community. So they have each of the religions have their own kind of religious vernaculars and things that are particular to their doctrine or their ways of looking at things. But in this awakening, there's a whole new language like non-duality, and even the word consciousness. I wouldn't have known, I didn't know when I was searching for help that was even a thing. I didn't have any idea what that meant even. So trying to figure out, like, how does one even find it? That was my big challenge. And I didn't realize at the time that community was what I needed. I didn't know that until I began getting some help after the suicide attempt. But then it was a matter of finding which community would be right, because in my experiences, I was encountering Jesus and Buddha and angels and God, but I wasn't welcome. When I started searching for community, I actually wasn't welcome in some of the Christian communities and the Buddhist communities because I didn't fit the mold. And people were sort of afraid of the mystical awareness. So when I ended up in India, I ended up in a Buddhist nunnery without having to adhere to the Buddhist doctrine. And so the nuns were very, very welcoming, just allowing me to be who I was in that way. And so as I visit communities now, I talk about how important that is to broaden our sort of range of welcoming people and to kind of loosen our own boundaries around religious ideologies or whatever to find that common ground of searching and fellowship and all of those sorts of things that we can find across religious borders.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really I noticed in your writing and your experience in India, you went and you had this community to support you, but your own inner work really was your inner work. Even with some of the higher ups, like in the Dalai Lama's community, said, you know, you are already getting the information directly. You do not need us to mediate or to guide you. And so I really noticed that you needed the community to hold you like a container, but you yourself were, it seems from reading your book, diving deeply into this experience yourself. Was that what it was like?
Yes, absolutely. But you know, so there were two parts of that. One is it was really nice to hear that I'm accessing things authentically or whatever, which I already sort of knew, but I didn't have the external validation for that. But at the same time, it really deepened my sense of loneliness on this journey because I was still struggling to talk about it. And I didn't know, I still don't know, a lot of people that have my kind of very deep origin-related kinds of mystical experiences. So because I don't have any kind of religious background, I don't have any filters. And so I get this really profound origin-related wisdom, the origins of existence, the origins of Christianity and Buddhism, and these origins of fear and thought and all of these sorts of things. And I've never had people that can say, oh yeah, you know, when that happened to me, here's how I managed it. So when I went to India and was being held in the nunnery and the communities there, I would do a lot of individual retreats. I still do. And so I spent an enormous amount of time in silence and just going in and getting this sort of wisdom, but then the figuring out what to do with that, how to integrate it into my life, was really very much my own journey. So I could sit at the, you know, in the dining hall or with the nuns or with people in the community and talk generally about things, but my own specific stuff, the integration process, was really my own internal work. And for me, that's what India has been. That's sort of my office, is that I can go and I can exist in a spiritual, as you say, container. And it's not just in the nunnery, just in general, India is such a beautiful place for that kind of being space. And so that's what, you know, that's what the work is in India. And then when I come to the United States, which I started doing when I released my book, to come out and start sort of having a voice publicly as a mystic, that's the time where the integration is really, it's sort of the application of all that has been happening. And so I come into this really sort of chaotic Western ideologies or whatever, and start learning how to talk about all of that wisdom in the context of what's happening in the Western world.
Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty big translation job, I would think.
Yes, especially bridging. In the last couple of years. You know, in the couple of years, just right after I released my book, I was really only talking about my journey. I was only able to say, look, all I know is to tell you what happened and kind of share some of the experiences themselves so people could resonate with the truth that was evident through the experience itself. But then in about 2016, definitely in 2016, I began to be able to talk about what all of the wisdom is that I've gleaned and how that applies to what I see happening in the world. And that has been a bigger challenge because it's easy to talk about what's happened in our lives. It's a whole other thing to sort of frame it then in a way that's applicable to other people in their lives.
Right, right. And how would you describe what you now know your work is after experiencing what you've experienced? And I know that things are still coming to you. I mean, this mm-hmm. is not, this process is still ongoing for you. And what clarity do you have at this point about your external work? Your internal work obviously is happening in India and these visions that you're receiving, and then translating those outwardly. What do you feel your work is in the world?
You know, I mentioned in my book about, I think it was the first or second, it might have been the very first experience that I had, was saying that, you know, my work would be understood when my journey was understood. And now I understand my journey. And this is why the title of the book is the Evolution of the Message of Love, the subtitle. Because in my second experience, I experienced very clearly that I am the message, which is different than being the messenger. Mm-hmm. So it is about embodying all that I have come into awareness of, and being the presence of that. And so this year, on my tour this year, I'm actually walking the audiences through step by step what I have re-experienced of the evolution of humanity's journey, literally from the origins of existence, what brings us into a conscious existence of life, into how we began exploring our potential as just pure awareness, fueled by divine love, and how we got to where we are in sort of a fear-based existence, and now where I know that we are going, where I have experienced about what all of this sort of holy shakeup is about in our world right now. So I'm literally walking everybody through that because I myself have re-experienced all of this. And so this is, you know, now my work is sort of the blend of saying what happened and how that applies through my own knowing of reliving that.
And in this conversation that you're having and what you're telling people, what are you being shown about this present time in which there seems to be so much tumult and fear? And it is in my take of it, it is like a portal time. It's a nexus time when we have the opportunity to really open up to this awakening that you're describing.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I very clearly see we're coming, without sort of giving the foundational background stuff, because it would take quite a while to talk about sort of where we started and our origins as the purity of love, and then how we kind of veered off into a fear-based separation consciousness. What I see very clearly happening right now is this huge transformation about the rising up that's happening through, I should say, the rising up of the presence more and more and more of divine love. And I talk about the qualities of divine love that are really evident from the origins of our existence, is that, you know, we're this pure awareness, we're part of a pure awareness that has a will, a volition, and it is purely cherishing. These are, you know, our origins start as this. And the origin state of awareness that has volition, that's cherishing, is entirely an unconditional state of being, that in our awareness, everything is equal and all of our potential is free to express what it is. And we're all in a unified and oneness state together, in a full state of acceptance of all that is. So these qualities, the unconditional, equal, free, unified acceptance of what is, we can see rising up more and more and more just dramatically in the last 100+ years. You can see more movements around unconditional love in all sectors of society. We can see huge movements towards equality at rocket speed relative to what we've been for eons. These more movements towards freedom to be who we are as we are, the more movements towards unity, more movements towards acceptance of what is. These are all the indicators of the presence of divine love rising up in our awareness more and more and really shifting our world. And at the same time, we're also seeing the falling away of these things that we created in fear, these expectations and rules and roles around gender and race and class and religion and education, etc., these things that were created in paradigms of inequality and oppression and separation, these things are beginning to fall away at the same time that we're seeing this presence of divine love more and more. And so this is the state that I see us coming into, that we are finally waking up enough to create the life we really want. And I don't mean that materialistically. I mean the life that humanity and all of us individually have been deeply yearning for. And so from my perspective, from the metaphysical perspective, it's an incredibly exciting time in our human evolution. And this is exactly why sort of all of us are here right now, is sort of being the explorers of love's potential right on that leading edge of this exploration.
Mm, yes. And you, what you just said about experiencing life and fully and not in a materialistic sense, what do you, when you come, I don't know if you experience culture shock when you come back and forth from India, but I'm guessing
you do.
I do. And no doubt reverse culture shock when you came back to the States for the first time and,
yes,
you know, home wasn't home, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. So my perception is that here in the West, we mistake abundance of life for materialism. What would you speak to that a little bit about our clinging to materialism as though that offers us the fullness of life?
Yeah, you know, I actually, in my talks this year, I walk people through how we shifted from the very pure states of exploration of life early on. And that is, we begin life by this movement of divine love that sort of wakes us up into a conscious awareness. And our exploration of our potential, our infinite potential as love or the expression of God, is originally through contrast. But that contrast is not like we think of it today. That contrast is like, this is good, this is another kind of good, this is good. It's all good because it's all God. And we're in a constant state of fascination and wonder and awe because we're cherishing all that we are a part of. We are aware that we're the oneness of life. Life is happening with us and through us and as us. And we take a critical turn in our exploration when one part of our awareness begins exploring through mental constructs. So it's not just about this thing that we're experiencing, it's the aboutness of experiences. So we're framing things just mentally, conceptually. And we take a critical turn when we happen into the mental concept of fear. And so now the mechanism of creation happens through the focus of our awareness and intention. And I don't have time here to talk about how that works, but the focus of our awareness and intention is the very thing that is the mechanism of how we create a reality that we perceive. And so when that mechanism is focused entirely, when our awareness and intention is focused in fear with the intention to protect, then we are now creating in a cycle of fear. And we've gone then from creating in love to creating in fear. And when we do that, we begin assigning meaning and value to absolutely everything in life because we need the good things to come to us to make us feel safe. And we need the bad things to go away because they threaten us. And so we begin this whole separation paradigm built in a good trumps bad model of life. In Buddhism, the you know, fundamental philosophy is that the basis of suffering is our attachments and our aversions. And so this is what I experienced very clearly in the good trumps bad model of life. So that good, we think in this, you know, bringing this material abundance into our life, that these are the things that make us feel in control, that we've got some power and domination, if you will, over our life circumstances. And all these good things make us feel good. And so materialistically, in a Western ideology, this is how we feel good about it. But it's obviously sort of short-lived. We still have that that hole in us somewhere that's not sated because that thing is not satisfied in a materialistic way. That longing is for our connection to the purity of love that doesn't have anything to do with the material life.
Yes. You also in your book talk about love and ego as the two possibilities before us to live out of ego, which is this fear-based mind.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us more about how you understand the ego and how people can begin to suspend belief in the stories that it weaves.
Yeah, you know, I want to say very clearly that I do not ascribe to the same kind of relationship with ego that a lot of spirituality does. And that is, I in no way see ego as an enemy or as something that is the thing to blame in life. Because, you know, there's ego is simply a word that we've created. And depending on people's definitions, but I would call ego essentially that which we've created, the idea we created, the identity that we created in fear. So all of the things that are fear-based, in particular that are identified with that which we label negative. And so all of the bad side, the things on the bad side of the good trumps bad equation. So the good that needs to feel in power and control, and the bad that it's trying to conquer, we could sort of put that in all of that as ego. But in reality, we didn't mean to do that. We just, you know, we were just exploring and we kind of got stuck in this cycle of this. And our ego in no way intends to harm us or to create this continual endless loop of suffering. And it is the thing itself that is in pain. And so I really promote a much more compassionate a relationship with that which we perceive to be our ego. And in understanding that the ego is the thing that at its very fundamental core is holding all of our sorrow. And we have made it such that pain in particular is the thing to be rejected, but our ego is entirely built in pain. So we're in this loop of endless self-rejection because we're just creating this crying out for love through our ego, and then we're rejecting that as something bad. So we're just creating and rejecting a part of ourselves. And so I really advocate for bringing the presence of love fully to that which we call the ego, so that there's really no separation between them. We're just bringing it all into a space of home within ourselves and then out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And the way I experience it, when we're resisting or battling the ego, we are not in that state of love. We are just sort of remaining captive to this idea that we're separate from love.
Right. Well, if you think about even the word battle is, you know, a domination kind of paradigm, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
exactly.
If we think that we're trying to overcome something, then we are automatically out of alignment with divine love, because divine love, the state of divine love, is a state of awareness that's fully accepting of everything that is. And you can't be accepting and resisting at the same time.
Exactly.
You can't be accepting and rejecting. And, you know, if you look at all of the qualities of divine love, unconditional means that you don't place conditions on something for it to be. So it's not an if or a when or because or as long as or all of those conditional things. It's entirely unconditional. And you can't have equality while you're thinking that there's a value system of good and bad, because then that's inherently an unequal field. You can't have oppression and the qualities of freedom to be fully as we are. You can't have a sense of separation and be in a unified state of oneness. You see, so all of these things built in a separation, fear-based paradigm is the exact opposite of our true nature. And so all of this pain that we hold in the good trumps bad paradigm, all of our egoic foundation, is that which is crying out repeatedly for connection to our own divine nature. And so this is the, you know, very clearly in my experiences, this is what we're coming into, is that understanding in a love approach to all that we've inherently historically been rejecting, all of it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
And I think that these times are really giving us the opportunity to embrace that and embody that in this moment when we can tend to see resistance as the answer to, you know, some of the tumult. But I see it as an invitation for us to make this quantum leap into the state of love.
Absolutely. But, you know, this is really a time for people to be challenged with that question of, am I really willing? I talk a lot about the critical process of inquiry into our own selves. Am I really willing? Am I really willing, especially in the face of all of that we see right now with this chaos in our world, if we ask, am I really willing to allow all of this to be in my field of awareness unconditionally, you know, as an equal and free and unified and accepted part of life experience? And especially right now, because there's so much anger up, the answer is often, no, I'm not. And that process of really owning the truth of, no, I'm not willing to be a presence of divine love in this moment, leads us into the question of why? What am I trying to reject in this moment? Because we really like our sense of righteousness and whatever, but if we look at it, it's fully based in fear. The reason that we don't want to accept it is because we're afraid that that's the thing that's going to take over life, or we're always going to be doomed to this. But we've already been doomed to this. Yeah. This is why we've been in it. So clearly we have to do something different than we've ever done before. And that is entirely the willingness to be the presence of divine love, because it is in being that state that then is the answer to our cry. And that alone, you know, through the mechanism of the creation, which is the focus of our awareness and intention, is if our awareness is on the state of love with the intention to fully witness all of it as a state of divine love, then that mechanism does all of the work. This is why the being is so important rather than the doing, because we're not moving towards something by doing. In our separation consciousness, we have this huge idea of inadequacy, that we think of ourselves as so tiny, and that puts us in this ideology of having to do so we can achieve, to overcome our deficiencies and all these sorts of things. So we've just been in this doing mindset. And the mechanism of creation works by being. And so we're now coming into this realization that we simply need to be the presence of divine love.
Yes. One of the visions that you describe in your book, you see these two screens side by side. Mm-hmm. You see the screen of the mind and the screen of the heart. And I love your book, so this is like one piece of everything else that I loved. But you close that description of that vision saying, the mind, therefore, only and always produces a false reality. Mm-hmm. To be God's light, then, is to be only and always of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so could you just talk to us about that being of the heart?
Yeah, I actually have an exercise. People can look on my YouTube channel. There's something called the box exercise, and it really is helping us come into realizing our sense of identity that we have created through mental constructs. It's entirely this illusory mentalized, you know, it's illusory because you can't hold it. All the things in our identity, which is our past, our stories, all of the my things, my fear, my judgment, etc. It's all of the things that we're holding in our mind that give us a sense of who we are. And I can walk people through sort of emptying that space out for a bit and dropping into the heart space. And when you come into this heart space in kind of a meditative way, realizing that there's still a sense of I, but it is a much vaster, infinite awareness, and that can kind of connect us in a state of being in which you can realize that this quiet state of the heart is entirely unconditional, and everything in it is in a state of equality and freedom and unity and acceptance. And realizing when we come out of that state then and back up into the mind, we can see the juxtaposition between the what's real and what's illusory. And so I recommend that people can check out that exercise. And I think I said in the book, as I recall, I was asking what it means to be the light of God, and whether that was actually a light or what it was. And so this was how the two screens came about, that the mind was sort of like, you can imagine it almost like a stick figure drawing, that it's trying to figure out what's real. And then the other screen was the heart, and it was this, you know, luminous, vibrant reality. And when you talk to people who've had near-death experiences, or people like me who encounter these divine realms, we talk about it, that it feels so much more real than this reality. And the reason is because it is, that you see that this is, even though, you know, in our sense, this feels vibrant in our sort of illusory reality. But when you experience the other, you just realize how rudimentary this actually is.
Mm-hmm. You're reminding, when I read that in your book and hearing you tell that again now in the stick figures, it reminds me of this dream that I had. At the end of the dream, I'm looking out, it seems like it's in, like, in Brazil or something, I'm looking out over this valley, and there's a little girl standing next to a hut, and she's drawn as a stick figure. Mm-hmm. It's like she's not entirely real. And this narrator in the dream tells me that traditionally the people lived in small wisdoms. Mm. When the winter came, it was time for them to come into community. And so when I saw that description in your book, it's like, oh, that's why she was a stick figure.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And the heart, I experienced the heart as that, you know, that is the, and it's the chakra too, of connection, of connectivity. And I know that when I'm in my heart space, everything is good and everything is fine and beautiful and vibrant and radiant and loving. And and I experience ego really as the mind when it's disconnected from that knowing. It's like the mind when it's cut off from the knowing of the heart and thinks that it's on its own.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because we, you know, our goal is not to get rid of our mind. Our mind is beautiful, and it's creative, and it's imaginative. And but the thing is, we're coming out of this time where we're controlled by being in the constant mind state, and allowing our mind into a partnership with the heart, so that our mind is in service to divine love. We're not here to make our mind an enemy. And so the whole process that's unfolding right now is about bringing all of that heart awareness into the opening space here, so that it is an integration with what's already here. So I also talk in my book about this moment where I have my mind, my heart, and my stomach all begin just this sort of buzzing in unison together. And this is what we're coming into, this our oneness, our sense of me being through the heart with the mind in partnership with that. And so to me, it's this time where finally our mind, it doesn't have to feel like it has to solve all of the world's problems. We just simply want to bring our mind home. This is all that this is about. And so I, you know, even as I'm sitting here, I'm getting a little bit emotional for my mind. it just feels like a huge relief that our precious mind has been working so hard trying to figure it all out. And that's the role of the mind, is to try to figure things out mentally. And now we can relieve it and just have it be in a more imaginative service role to divine love.
Yes. As you're speaking, I'm reminded of a prophecy that comes out of South America, of this being a time when the condor and the eagle fly together, and the condor being the symbol of the heart and the eagle being the symbol of the mind.
Yes,
and
exactly.
This reunification. Yep. Yeah.
That's everything that I have seen now for 18 years. This, all of it points exactly to that. And, you know, when you break it down, it's just very simple that we're coming into this time now of integrating all of ourselves to be whole right here. We've had this idea that we're trying to get out of this reality, and I don't advocate for that at all. We're trying to bring everything into this reality, and to have this, you know, be the point of celebration right here, that everything is possible, and we're the vessels through which all of that is happening in a beautiful way. It's extraordinary right now. I know that, you know, the world feels very chaotic, and it needed to. I think I talk in my book about The Buddhist teachings of fracturing of the mind, that when the light hits the darkness of the mind, there's a fracturing that occurs, and then we see that fracturing reflected in our reality. And we can look in the last couple of years at all of the fracturing that's been going on. There's been like this huge state of PTSD everywhere, in the Western world in particular. But that's a beautiful sense of, as this presence of divine love is increasing more and more, all of the pain has come from the depths of humanity up to be included in this healing. So now, when we look out, for the first time in humanity's evolution, all of us around the world can hear our cries for union with love at the same time. And so now we have, you know, every choice available for how to respond. And now we know that the key is that we respond to all of this pain that we're seeing with and as the presence of divine love. And so this is the process of bringing it all home. I'm actually getting a little lightheaded as I'm talking about this. And the sort of the beauty and the wonder of all that's unfolding. It's such an extraordinarily exciting time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, truly. Well, Mary, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. And you are traveling all over, speaking to groups. People can go on your website, unwittingmystic.com, and find out your itinerary, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to be on the West Coast, shortly in Seattle. I know you're coming to the East Coast for Philadelphia listeners. Mary is coming to our region in October. So I really encourage everyone to go on unwittingmystic.com and check out your itinerary, Mary, and also check out your book, which is just extraordinary.
Yeah,
is there anything
you.
Else you want to say before we sign off?
Yeah, I just want to say to you, Patricia, a big thank you for your book. I also read your book and loved that. So also thank you to you for your willingness and your work, and to tell your truth, to tell your story, to tell your own evolution, to do the work of this podcast, because this time of telling our stories and letting our experiences and the wisdom that we glean and the awakening through our own hearts ripple out into the collective, giving other people, we talked very early on about community. This is the way that we're creating the community for other people to come into our awareness and vice versa. And it's a really important time to do that. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for all that you're giving to our world and allowing to ripple out through your work and your presence. I love you, and I'm so happy that we're doing this in the same journeying time together.
Thank you, Mary. And I look forward to seeing you here in Philadelphia in October.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very kindly, Patricia.